But as to economics and money, we're going to try the Western Hemisphere route. And then our principal problem will be Canada. And we're going to have to lean on Canada very hard, because Canada is inclined to play ball economically and monetarily for Canada, or at least it thinks so. That's a big one, because it's not, you know, Canada is not a member of the American system. It is not in the Rio Pact. It gets a free ride in all these things because we're around, rather than the other way. So those are options. The Pacific may be another option. Maybe Europe is obsolete and doesn't know its own best interests and is doomed to become a Soviet colony. Well, it's still a big world out there, with the population of Asia enormously greater than the population of Europe. And it's got Japan and Taiwan and South Korea and Singapore, the ASEAN nations. It's got a lot of interesting stuff. And all of those possibilities, which you say are a deal with half a century, but what's that in the life of a nation? A day. Sure, for us, it's the beginning and end of life. But for a nation or a region, it's a moment, hardly a pause in the history of the world. That's what I mean. You were there.
The conference on security and cooperation in Europe, popularly known as the Helsinki Review Conference, is scheduled to begin in Madrid on November the 11th. It is generally identified with human rights issues, but it also has, you know, elements of economic cooperation and military security. It's the one place in which all the nations of Europe, except Albania, plus Canada and the United States, convene together, and although they have to operate by consensus, you see that as a forum for the Western powers to meet and talk about their common problems that you suggested in your main comments?
I do not. I consider the Madrid conference extremely desirable and very useful, but I think it will be as useful as the limitation of its purposes. And all these diffuse discussions about everything under the sun don't get you anywhere, except everybody enjoys being there. So I would have it stick to human rights. That's where it belongs for the moment, and that's the most directed and pointed. And I'm a member, by designation of the Senate, of the Helsinki Commission. So I'm not speaking because of disinterest. Very useful in emigration from the Soviet Union and in other civil liberties matters and human rights matters. Very useful. Irreplaceable. But in my judgment, just a distraction on the theory that it's going to be able to discuss everything. It'll discuss it, and then what? They go back to another meeting a year from now.
Senator? How do you feel about America's role in the UN? Is there a need now for a reassessment of our role in view of the fact that the UN has become a forum for anti-Israel manipulation by both the Arab world and the Marxist-oriented Third World? Do you feel that the $800 million that we are contributing is giving us our necessary position that is important for the United States and the rest of the world?
I think the $800 million is buying something that's useful, and they keep bubonic plague from spreading from Africa to the United States. It may help the environment or the postal service or the education of the Hottentots and how to pasteurize their milk. All of it very useful, and I continue to belong and do my utmost to keep it on a relatively good track. And there might come a moment when the Security Council or the General Assembly could step in to stop a drift toward or a war or a sudden crisis. So I would not in any way denigrate the UN. But to try to change it now is a distraction, and we don't have time for distractions. It's not too unlike the Helsinki conference. Matter of fact, if anything, it's more relevant and germane to the peace issue. But I would have no illusions about the fact that it'll do nothing but delay the works while they talk. It's not like the Senate of the United States. You don't vote until you stop talking. But it's unlike the Senate in the sense that an Iran-Iraq war can suddenly break out while you're talking. So obviously, that is not the handy mechanism that I'm talking about. Really, I'm talking about the fact that the new policy of the United States must be to work with those who will work with us and to forget about it like we did Tarawa in the Pacific in World War II if they won't work with us. And that's nothing opinionated about that. That's just good hard-headed sense. And there are plenty around who will work with us. We're not alone by any means. But they realize we're not very selective. We work with everybody. Well, that's fine on human rights and humanity and so on. But it's not fine if you want to do something affirmative, because it just ends up in talk. You want to recognize whoever you want to recognize.
Terry?
Senator, the United States is intending, at least ostensibly, a neutral position in the present Persian Gulf conflict. My question is, in the event of the danger of a dismemberment of Iran, as at least has been suggested by some commentators on the war, in your view, would the United States and should the United States stand by and accept it as a new status quo?
If we can do nothing else about it, yes. If we can do anything whatever about it, no. The dismemberment of Iran would be a disastrous development for U.S. foreign policy and for peace in the world. Would be a constant source of irredentism and of international strain. It could never give the world any rest because it would be such an alien enterprise and so threatening, at least for the next 10 years. To the operation of the industry, indeed of anything, in the Western world. So we should, in my judgment, make a deal on the hostages and the spare parts and whatever other stuff has to be thrown in order to prevent Iran by its own actions from being dismembered. That's my judgment on what ought to be present policy. We ought to see that they're not subdued, notwithstanding that they're an outlaw, because that's to our interest.
I think we have time for two more questions, yes?
Yes, Senator, you just made a remark on Czechoslovakia and passed a comment to Latin America, yet you have your own backup here.
I didn't get the word. I didn't get your question.
Yes, you just made a comment on Hitler's backyard.
Yeah.
And a passing comment on Latin America. Yeah. You have your own backyard here. If nobody seems to remember South America and Latin America with enormous political and human resources, except when it's too late, especially now that it's passing through a very special period of political and social ferment, will you have some specific proposals regarding Latin America?
Yes, I would hope that we could develop again a gifted personality like Nelson Rockefeller, who revolutionized our relations with Latin America as coordinator for Inter-American Affairs. That is long overdue. It can't be the same attitude, a good neighbor policy and so on is obsolescent. But there is another relationship to Latin America which could be in order. Unfortunately, Latin America suffers greatly than most other places from what I call the gimme policy. That is, what do we give them? Not what they give us. That goes right from Mexico to the Straits of Magellan. And it's a tough one. They've gotten so used to it. But again, we may have to be selective about who we work with. And even if it's to begin with the Andean countries, we have to start somewhere. And people have to know that if you don't work with us, we don't work with you. But I deeply believe that a complete renaissance of our policy with the countries to the south of us is essential. And we're going to have to invest some money in the Caribbean. That's abjectly poor. It's also resource poor. And again, a resolute position in respect of those who can be brought along so they become yardsticks, where for a time it looked like Puerto Rico might be, becomes also very important because in politics, emulation is a very big factor. So I would agree with you about this, but I don't think it can necessarily be a global, all-inclusive proposition. One more question.
Yes,
Duke. Senator, as I sit here close to you, I can't help but preface my question with an expression of personal feeling that I'm sure some of us share. I feel most strongly that your position, your stance on these questions, which are most important to us as we face the next 4 years, are stronger and more enlightened and more enlightening than ever, and more germane to the subject. That one of those chairs down there was to be occupied today by an old friend of mine who asked me yesterday, had the temerity to ask me if I thought the senator was losing his grip. Well, I did a lapel job on him, and I think I frightened him to death, and he didn't show up this morning. My question, sir, I'm sure that in the last several months you've had ample occasion to meet with the Republican presidential candidate, and I'm also sure that in our minds today are questions. And I just simply want to ask you how you feel your point of view and your strong stance, how does it stack up with the way Governor Reagan views the future with particular respect to foreign relations and foreign affairs, sir?
Well, first, let me say that I wish to make no recommendation on that score this morning, because that would be outside the character of this meeting. I am for Reagan, and I will vote for him, and I've been out to what extent I could by campaigning for him, and I'll tell you why. That's the best way to answer the question. I believe that for the near term, a somewhat more militant view than we have had is necessary. I believe that Carter's view of the foreign policy of the country leapfrogs the present and is more in the traditional sense of the U.S. foreign policy than in the sense of what we need right now. I think right now the United States needs to have a rather cold eye in foreign policy and needs to realize that it is on the short, not the long side, and that the curve is down, that to reverse it, there will have to be a harder stance in military preparation and in alliances and relationships, in risk-taking, and in a definition of what are our true vital interests. Whereas down the road, could be 1, 2, 3, 4 years, I can't predict that, but not too long, but period of years, we will again revert to the beneficent, internationalist, all-inclusive, peace-seeking of the United States. I don't think the time for that is right now. I think it's distracting, and I think it's misleading. In first place, I don't believe the American people feel that way. I think they're very hard-nosed themselves. So I would hope very much that whichever one of these two candidates, and I've given you my perception, the American people feel will lead them down a harder line road without being isolationists. We have got to, we live, and if we die, it will be because of our alliances, and whether they succeeded or failed, will be their choice for president. Thank you all very much.
The National Committee thanks Senator Javits for his appearance this morning, and thank you very much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Great to see you always. Good to hear you. Frank, thank you.
Jack.
Hello, Herb. How are you?
Fine. I think it's straight.
I am immediate past national president of the American Jewish Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Yes, yes.
That means something in New York.
Yeah.
Okay?
But that Rabbi?
Pardon? I'm Rabbi Arthur Herzberg,
yes.
The immediate past national president.
But since I have you on the phone now,
yes.
Do you want to just wing it for 35 seconds, and then if we don't... if
all right, go ahead. Put on
okay.
A tape. Go on, put on a tape recorder.
It's running now.
Okay. Senator Javits, in the mind of the rest of the Senate, is the spokesman for all the interests of the Jewish community. To my certain knowledge on Israel, on Soviet Jewry, on many matters of domestic policy, at least 40 senators will first ask themselves, what does Jack Javits think? And then they will make up their mind. It is of the most important. It is of vital importance that he be in the Senate. There's your 35.
Things. I welcome anything that represents a thaw in the relations between the two countries. We have to be vigilant about Cuba, but where it is possible to get civilized conduct, we should hope to encourage it.
Do you credit anyone in particular with getting Michael's release?
Yes, Senator Javits,
Senator,
and Congress.
Javits, Senator, Congressman Gilman, Congressman Biagi, Ted White, Congressman Weiss, and Congressman
Garcia.
Yes.
And why did they? Why do you think they finally let you out?
Why? The Cubans?
Yes.
I don't know.
Because we worked on it.
Because,
months and years, and Senator Javits,
pushed, but
the Congressman
the
asked.
I don't know.
I know if you look back,
it's got to be pressure. It's got to be from the states, but not from
ask
from
Sean.
Individual.
Ask
from
Sean,
individual,
my 12-year-old. She
from,
knows what
from
makes
my mom,
work.
From Alice Pollock, from Mary Bailey, from Senator Javits, from concerned individuals who pushed. I'll say that our administration has done nothing for us. Without them, we felt no help with them, from them at all.
Yeah, I'm holding it.
I hope to meet them
holding it in the basement of the State Department. So for the first time, the State Department will be on top of the situation.
Death threats and solitary confinement.
For Americans, no, but there are such things. Yes.
How do they treat you there?
Worse than they would in an American jail. It's a difficult thing to explain. It's something that you have to be there to experience. You know, it's a horrible situation. The whole thing, not only personally. You know, I mean, being there, but I mean the whole situation in general. Just being home is wonderful.
Beyond the watching the debates tonight, what are your immediate plans?
I won't print that.
It's not going to be watching a football game.
No, I'm not going to watch a football game. I don't know what to say.
Why don't you ask my 12-year-old daughter and Senator Javits?
Listen,
ask her what she learned out of this whole thing. She's going to be 13 on Election Day. Sean, where are you? Sean!
She ran away.
The presidential election.
So what did you think about for 7 years?
I grew. I gained a lot of political awareness. It was a time for introspection, a time for reflection, a time for growing, a time for learning, a time to convey to every American that I can to become politically involved in his country, to become aware of his country, what the United States of America stands for. To really become the country that we once were, that we were recognized as, to be that once again. I feel, especially with the Carter administration, that we're losing ground with world prestige. And communism is a part of it. But all smaller nations are taking advantage of the United States in every respect. And I feel that it's every one of our responsibilities to get to know our senators who have performed, Senator Javits, for example. Although a lot of people don't believe it, former President Nixon. What I say is that we need strong leadership for our country.
Can you describe what took place the day your boat was captured?
That's a fairly long story. Basically, we were fired upon, we were taken under escort, we were interrogated, and then we were allowed to live on the boat for 4 days. And then we were taken to state security for almost 3 months, interrogated and then brought to the jail, just briefly.
What'd they give you to eat there?
Chicharro, Cuban food. It's like a split pea type food and rice.
For 17 months?
Well, not completely. We had fish occasionally. We had Russian beef occasionally. We had soup, eggs. Just very, very basic necessities.
Do you think the Carter administration did enough to get you out? Or did
I didn't think the Carter administration did anything for us. As a matter of fact, I don't believe that were they to have the opportunity to get us out would be able to get us out. I don't feel the State Department would either because of the lack of, the lack of involvement that the State Department has shown me.
Is this an endorsement for Ronald Reagan?
Pardon?
Is that an endorsement for Ronald Reagan?
Yes, it surely is.
Excuse me.
For strong leadership.
If you want to see Michael, we need to get. It's just too many. We're not used to lots of people like that.
I've never been in a situation
okay.
like this.
How do you feel about seeing your son, having him back?
I'm floating. I still am. It's very difficult for me to believe that I really with a lot of help, 5,000 congressmen, not that many, 405 congressmen and senators, about 5,000 people altogether, we move mountains. And you can make your government work if you push it.
What's the first thing you thought when you saw him in Florida?
It's when I didn't see him come off the plane. He was the last one off because he wanted to see everybody's reaction first. And I think I turned white, somebody said, you know, because I kept saying, where is he, where is he? And then he finally came off, and then I realized what Michael, you know, he's my Michael.
Senator Javits, I'd like to ask you a quick question.
Thank you.
What specifically brought you down? What specifically brings you down here tonight? Why did
Two
you
things.
Decide to make this greeting?
Two things. One, his mother, Sonny, was really heroic. Just unbelievable. She really persevered, cultivated every office, and the assistants in every office, and kept eternally at it, kind of the model of a mother who feels that her son should be released. Secondly, I believe we ought to encourage civility between Cuba and ourselves. We thoroughly disapprove of Cuba, what it's doing here and what it, in the Western Hemisphere. and what it's doing in Africa. At the same time, they're 90 miles away. We have to live with them. And when they let loose, for example, a great many people who inundate us, though we're anxious to receive as many as we can, it becomes a great national problem. Similarly, when they harbor Russian troops, whether in training or not, and comparably, and when they engage in any other activity, like seizing young people like Mr. Seitler. But civil and the hijacking, for example, our hijacking agreement seems to be working from time to time. So I'm here to, as I say, do two things. One, express my satisfaction at a mother who fought so valiantly, and second, to try to encourage some kind of relations with Cuba, even though they must be very suspicious and we cannot take anything for granted. Some relationship is better than simply confrontation.
Do you believe that Castro's decision to let these prisoners go at this particular time had anything to do with the presidential election?
I couldn't tell you. I'm sure it had to do with whatever pleased Castro and whatever he thought was good for him. It had nothing to do, I don't believe, with trying to please the United States. Thank you.
Thank you.
Puzzling reports have emerged recently about the administration's plan to sell Saudi Arabia equipment that could transform U.S.-built jet fighters sold some time ago into offensive weapons. The president had agreed. I'll strike that out. All right, start it again. Okay. Puzzling reports persist about the administration's plans to sell Saudi Arabia equipment that could transform U.S.-built jet fighters sold to them some time ago into offensive weapons. 68 senators, including myself, have reminded the president that earlier assurances were that they were only be used for defensive purposes. I have asked the president to reaffirm these assurances in order to close this issue. All right, leave it. Wait a minute. Damn thing. Puzzling when you do it. Recent reports that the administration is actively considering reversing its decision after election, which said that the United States would not sell Saudi Arabia equipment for the purpose of making U.S.-built jet fighters into offensive weapons, are raising very serious questions. The president should reaffirm this decision as requested by 68 senators, including myself. Otherwise, the decision must be protested, and if the issue is to be reopened and not considered closed, consultation with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee should be undertaken immediately.
This is Alan Nicholson in New York City with Senator Javits. Sunny Seitler, the mother of the Glen Cove, New York youth, Michael Seitler, just released from a Cuban prison, said today she was appalled by the lack of cooperation she got from the State Department in her effort to secure her son's release. Speaking from her Glen Cove home, she credited Senator Javits for playing a major role in bringing her son home. The cut runs 32 seconds and begins on my count. 3, 2, 1...
Getting my son Mike and the other Americans out of a Cuban prison was an 18-month uphill struggle for me. I was appalled at the total lack of interest on the part of the administration and the State Department. Then I approached over 400 Senate and House members. It is to them that Mike and the others owe their release, and especially to Senator Javits, who played a major role in bringing Mike's case to the attention of Cuban authorities. It is for those efforts, and especially for caring, that Mike and I are extremely grateful to Senator Javits.
Senator Javits was at LaGuardia yesterday.
Yes, I really wanted to thank him because he took the time to care, and right from the beginning, if there was something to be done, he did it. And all I had to do was ask.
Very well. Okay, Mrs. Seidman. I appreciate it very much.
By the way, Liv Holzman didn't do zilch.
No?
Zilch. I had these columns that I had, the flow chart, to keep track of what I had done and what I didn't do and who did what. And there was this column I had marked what they did, meaning the congressmen and senators. And under Senator Javits, every possible column that could have been checked was checked. Under Liz Holzman, not one column was checked. She did nothing.
What did you think about the debates last night? Well, did you get that?